Thank you, everybody, for coming. Please welcome our next speaker, Max Rossmann. He has a background in chemical engineering and philosophy, and in his next talk, he will share his ideas with us about how we can make models, which we could use for more analytical processes, to make them, how he could make them more immersive through narrative. Yes. Max, please give me...
So, yeah, thanks for this introduction. Well, I'm Max, and as you have already heard, I have no IT background. I'm actually a PhD student in the field of technology assessment. This means we make something like eco-balances and surveys about acceptance and risk perception, for example, of stationary batteries or biogas plants or the nutrition of the future and so on. And on the other hand, my PhD is about the role of narratives in science. And I actually want to use this talk mainly to come into talk with you. Well, last year I was for the first time at the Gulasch Programmiernacht. And yeah, I loved this openness spirit. And some weeks later, I started Python programming. And yeah, this was really great, and there were these Jupyter notebooks, and they helped a lot to get into the material. And then I had some thoughts about the term computational narratives, and I want to come in to talk with you about, so that we can maybe later discuss a little more about the ideas on this. So I will just start with a question. So that's mainly my question on my vision with the computational narratives. Can computational narratives improve the transparency, the collaboration, and the participation by better connecting the scientific modeling with efficient narratives? So the idea is, you can see, on one hand, you have something like the public discourse about technology. This is what you read in the newspapers and in the program of political parties. Then social scientists can analyze these discourses and find out what are the main narratives, the key narratives. And on the other hand, there's public participation. And then they bring this somehow into science, and scientists make models to assess these technologies, for example, from an ecological perspective. But if you think of, for example, you have this scenario with biogas plants, and you have another scenario with battery storages, and you want to compare this in the energy grid, your model will be unlimited complex. And this is not possible to model. And if you would try so, no one would understand this model in the end. And so the idea is to find out about the key narratives and then somehow make better models that just follow the key narratives and take the most important aspects into account so that people in the end can still use these models for their personal assessment. The other feedback circle here is the scientific discourse. So if we talk of scientific knowledge, then it's peer-reviewed knowledge. That means scientists publish papers and other scientists read them. And if they think this is good science, they will be published. And this is like another world or another system, you can say. Yeah, and the idea is you could put the computational narratives, these Jupyter notebooks and so on displays, because everyone can read a narrative and follow the storyline. And then you can play inside this narrative and play around with the data. You can look at the sources. You can look what models are used. And so maybe this can improve this interplay. So the question is, does it serve as a medium or a boundary object for both worlds, the public and the science? Yeah, and while I didn't give some table of contents, but it's mainly, I will look at these computational narratives as games of make-believe, as narratives and as models. And yet, just to give a further overview, here are three quotes that somehow seemed to be related to me, and that's the idea. First thing is from IPython, that's a project page from Jupyter Notebook and so on, Project Jupyter. In order for data and the computations that process and visualize the data to be useful for humans, they must be embedded into a narrative, a computational narrative. On the other hand, this is Roman Frick. He's some philosopher of science who works mainly on this idea. He says, model descriptions are like the text of a novel. They are props in games of make-believe. And on the other hand, this is of the Dungeons and Dragons player's book, basic rule books. Like those games of make-believe, Dungeons and Dragons is driven by imagination. And so somehow, you could also say it's not only about philosophical reflections on Jupyter Notebook, or do coding and roleplay games somehow belong together? So I already heard that some of you do roleplay games or cosplay and so on. This is some tabletop game from Dungeons and Dragons, and I want just to say, you have got the dice, you have rule books, and on the other hand, you can write your own stories or you buy a storybook, and then you're going through adventures, but you cannot do anything, you have to dice, and somehow it's then restrained what can happen and what not, and there are rules, and it's not just arbitrary. So on one hand, you have the narratives, and this is also part of the Dungeons & Dragons player's basic rules. The Dungeons & Dragons roleplay game is about storytelling in words and sorts of swords and sorcery. It shares elements with childhood games of make-believe. Like those games, Dungeons & Dragons is driven by imagination. It's about picturing the towering castle beneath the stormy night sky and imagining how a fantasy adventurer might react to the challenges the scene presents. So here you have to immerse and follow the narrative. On the other hand, you have the models. The Dungeons & Dragons rule set gives structure to the stories, a way of determining the consequences of the adventurer's action. Players roll the dice to resolve whether their attacks hit or miss, or whether their adventures can scale a cliff, roll away from the strike of a magical lightning ball, or pull off some of dangerous task. So I also once played this with the dice. I played mainly on the computer roleplay games. And yeah, my experience was like this. I played something like some nomad druid, and when we entered the first town, I wanted to talk with everyone. I wanted to go into the bar and to spend some money for drinks and so on. And then, well, what happens? There was some discussion with the dungeon master, and he said, well, characters of your kind don't behave like this. And I said, well, but the rule set says nothing especially about this. Maybe I'm not as all the other normal Norman druids. They said, no. Suddenly, the sky turned black and some lightning bolt hit the Norman druid. And this was like the end of my pen and paper career. But I didn't really understand what I made wrong, because I didn't know, it wasn't in the rule set. What was the problem? And yeah, now I understand a little better what a narrative is about. And so we come to the next point. What is a narrative? And here we start with Aristotle. He says, he is one of the first one who thought of the language, of the power of these tragedies as text. And he says, a tragedy is an imitation of action that is serious and has a wholeness in existent. And the important thing is the wholeness in existent. And what is this? Well, it is which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Okay, special, cool. When I read this the first time, and this was quoted so many times in this narrative science stuff, I just wondered what's so special about that it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. He further says, a beginning is a beginning, and there's nothing before, but when there's a beginning, you expect that something comes afterwards. So it's like immerse into a whole narrative world. This is the beginning. So if you start reading something, then there's the beginning, and this is like some principle of generation. You have to start imagination. So I could say today we learn about narratives, and if you follow me with this, then you are immersed. So a narrative is a whole lingual reference to a sequence of events. What I find very interesting, this concept is also used in psychology, and there it is known as the narrative self-constitution view. This is, for example, used for trauma therapies, and it says, narrative self-constitution view says that we constitute our identities as persons by generating and operating with an autobiographical narrative that meets the articulation and reality constraints. So on one hand, it's again articulation. You have to tell a story about yourself, And on the other hand, it's not only you who tells the story, it's also people who continue the story with you. And this means your individuality is not like you are person X with properties, whatever. You can say, I'm the story of myself and I'm the author of myself, and other people are the co-authors, and we all together live in stories. So McIntyre is some moral philosopher, he says. He also takes this perspective and says, I can only answer the question, what am I to do, if I can answer the prior question of what story or stories do I find myself a part? And this gives you a connection to your birth, to your home, to all the people that surround you, and to all what you make out of the things that you perceive. So it's about the stories you tell. So in reflection, we are the protagonists of our role-play game, we can say, and we have to find out what our stories or what your stories are about. This is really interesting. This also has an impact to sociology, and there we can analyze narratives for collaboration and orientation. So, for example, narratives like visions or reports or dystopia, they have an effect on people. For example, if you look at your mobile and then you watch a whole episode of Black Mirror, you will behave differently, because in these episodes or in the series, you learn what this actually means or what this can mean. So the meaning changes with this. But there are also visions like the car-friendly city, and then people start to build things like Pforzheim. Or there are other visions like the smart grid vision or the automatization vision. And what all these visions have in common, on one hand, they bring people to orientate what is important today and what will be important tomorrow. For example, one can say, the problem is we are dependent to big industry groups. If something breaks, we must buy expensive spare parts, and no one knows how to repair. That's stupid. Let's start a fab lab and share our knowledge and to become independent. And this is like a vision. And if you repeat this vision can spread all over the planet, and fab labs will rise. So that's the idea how this helps to orientate. On the other hand, there's the discursive reflection about such a vision. So if you are in the fab lab, you can start, what happens if we are funded by some industry? Are we dependent on them? Are we exploited from them? How much can we be independent if we rely to money of them? And this continues the shaping of the groups or the collective identity, so that the fab lab becomes an individual actor. On the other hand, it's collaboration. So that's the question, what's my role in this game? If you, for example, go to some fab lab, a lot of stuff has to be done. They're hungry, they need some place to be, they need someone who cares about some insurance, who does some public relation, and so on. And so it's not necessary that there's some head of this thing. In those collaborative actors, mainly there must be a vision, and people can find out what is their role in this vision or in this narrative. So this helps for orientation. Or for example, when you think of the car-friendly city, there was this guiding image, and well, the economists know how to calculate something, and the engineers knew how to build roads, streets, and the lawyers, they also did something about this and so on. Yeah, but the most important thing is narratives and visions, say, become active. Like, I have a dream, and this activates people, and so people do something. So if narratives do so much for collaboration and orientation, then there comes Project Jupiter, and it's also about narratives. So actually, such a computational narrative could be the base for all this stuff that I just mentioned. So that's the whole quote. Computers are good at consuming, producing, and processing data. Humans, on the other hand, process the world through narratives. Thus, in order for the data and the computations to process and visualize the data to be useful for humans, they must be embedded into a narrative, a computational narrative that tells a story for a particular audience and context. First, a single computational narrative needs to span a wide range of contexts and audiences. Second, These computational narratives need to be reproducible. And third, computational narratives are created in collaborations. I will just, for those who don't know, but actually I think you all know Jupyter Notebook better than I do, but that's like the structure of it. You can see it's, you open it and you go it through it, you follow the linear structure. You start on top reading and then you go down and further down. And here's like the principle of generation. This is some tutorial for machine learning, and you read this and then you can, you know about the context, and then expectation rise. So you start to immerse into this game, and then there comes some computational code following certain rules, some visualizations, and then the interesting thing is, afterwards, after this visualization, you interpret these visualizations following the plot that was introduced in the beginning. So it's not arbitrary what you see in these plots, it depends to the story. And in these Jupyter notebooks, it's bound together. You have the code and the story in one document. Yeah. And this is some plot, for example, from my biogas plant. I can tell you now, this is the energy price, the stock market price, and the blue is when it's a good price and there's energy is sold, and the green line is the gas storage, and so yeah, there's some like a simulation of it. But the thing is, you understand this, or you say this is a representation of a biogas plant if you follow the narrative to this point. And then you can ask questions, what is missing from the biogas plant in your imagination? So you think of a biogas plant and you say, okay, there must be some warm storage, or there must be some agricultural simulation, or you don't ask for this, but this depends on the imagination. But how can I distinct a good model from a not valid model? And there the fiction field model comes into play. And again, it's about games of make-belief in philosophy of science. Roman Frick says, model descriptions are like the text of a novel. They are props in games of make-belief. Games based on public rules are authorized. Games involving ad hoc rules are unauthorized. By definition, a prop is a representation if it is a prop in an authorized game. What does it mean by this? Well, we explore and develop models in the imagination from an internal or participatory perspective, and we originally compare models and targets from within an extended imagined context. In this case, we are fully immersed in the game, and we assume an attitude of imagination towards the relevant propositions. However, we can also exit the game and assume an external and descriptive perspective. So, on one hand, we immerse, follow the narrative, and we only find the representation in our imagination. On the other hand, we can quit or exit this imagination and analyze the model constraints. And this makes, for example, the electrocardiogram not only a plot of some physical data, this makes it some indicator for the health or vitality of some human that is connected to this. Or on the other hand, this makes this not just a plot with nice colors, it makes this some representation of a biogas plant. But what about things like this, like a Bitcoin price prediction? Are they based on authorized props? Well, I found it quite nice. Last year, there was this big hype on this blockchain and coin stuff, and there was a website called TradingView, and there people share and discuss their models for IOTA prediction and whatever. And it's, yeah, you can look at it as art, or you can think or wonder if people spent their money by this, and some of my highlight was this. Well, he found out that it's actually a circle, and it's sometimes following. When the circle goes down, the price goes also down. So he predicted, it made a good prediction for this time because IOTA really crashed. And if you follow the data-driven view, you can say a model is good if it only fits to data. But if this is all, you need arguments why this is not a good strategy. This is something I also find quite nice because it looked like this bureau graph things people can paint. Yeah, I actually wonder what's the game of this model. We can say, well, we immerse and follow this, and follow the story of you can become rich because you're smarter than the rest, and then there are some props that lead you to immerse and to take this serious and follow them. Or you ask, is this plausible that I can predict the market price with something like this? On the other hand, with a fiction view, so we can choose both perspectives, we can argue for the model world representation or ask the question, does the narrative refer to public rules? And that's the key of this fiction view and models. If it's not based on public rules, it's not authorized, and then it's no representation. So this is especially important when you think of climate prediction. It's not like, it's not only about does the data of today fit to the models, it's also about how the model is built and all these public rules that are behind or that play a role in this model. So the fiction view on models, what we can say, the model system represents a target system in imagination on the basis of authorized rules and props. Or you look at the Dungeons and Dragons book. Dungeons and Dragons, or the physicist, or the VDE rule set gives structure to the stories. And this is a way out of determining the consequences of the adventurous action. And we can choose. On one hand, we immerse and follow the narrative in a fictional model world comparison and reflect plausibility and completeness. On the other hand, we can exit and analyze the logical consistency of authorization, references, and interpretation. And just a link, there's a lot of philosophical debate about truth and fiction and fictional operators, and all this is done in logic, and it's quite complicated and interesting, or you can also say it's some kind of art, depends on what you want to make out of it. So, the last two things. This is like my summary then in the end. Data narratives represent the reproducible experience to make within the data model. In computational narratives, you as individual and as a collective, so that's the clue of it, follow a storyline and explore the constraints by playing around with the data, the variables, the model, and code. And that's the idea. Maybe the computational narrative might theoretically serve as a technical infrastructure for better collaboration and reproducibility. So that's also an important point in science right now. By establishing, organizing, and devolving a shared problem-solving perception with transparent references to the given rules. And now my question is to all those of you who have more practical experiences with these notebooks, do they? So that's the question to you. Thanks.
We still have time for some questions, so maybe, is there any questions in the audience?
So this concept of computational narrative sounds like it would be potentially quite useful for teaching people about technology and about computing. So do you know if there's been any work on that?
Well, my experience, when I started to learn Python, I was always referred to these Jupyter notebooks, and they helped really a lot. And if I have any question, I'm looking up some Google or something like this, and I come to some thing that looks like a Jupyter notebook so far. So I think in this informatics scene, this is quite common. But I also think that it could serve a lot for engineering and for all this other stuff. So I think, yeah, that's mainly a question on you. What do you think? Do you think it could serve for it? I think it could, but I don't know if it's done so much. What do you think?
maybe I would have one thought to that is, I feel that narrative is often driven by conflict. This can be conflict between individual actors or conflict between an actor and the world. Mm-hmm. How do you maybe... You could, that would be a thought, how one could put this kind of conflict or position this conflict in the narrative of a model.
That's a good thing. So Mary Morgan was also a philosopher who deals with this fiction view on models, and she said, she compared it with a detective game if you're doing some modeling. It's like you have some question, like what is better as a flexibility option, biogas plants or battery storages? Yeah, and that's like the point. And then you have to find out, and you are looking up things to solve this question. You look up how a battery is built, how this is built, and you're collecting data and comparing data, and you're following this. And this is also part at the structuralist narrative discourse analysis. So then they say, to make the narratives comparable, we need always some hero and some antagonist. And this is, for example, you can say the hero is then the technology, for example. You can say there are so many people on this planet, we can change our behavior and consume, or we'll be forced to change or consume. But the hero, nutrition of microalgae, can save us from this conflict. What must be done that microalgae can save us? And then, oh, well, let's think of, okay, they may not produce so much carbon dioxide. Let's look up this, and that's the way how this already, there's some interaction between this conflict stuff. So it's driven by this, yes.
Any other questions?
It's also okay, yeah.
So I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on the feedback loop mm-hmm. between the data analysis and the actual story. So the question is, of course, you want to like reaffirm your story, but of course, if you're looking for the truth, there's this uncomfortable thing called reality, which means your story may be off, mm-hmm. and you have to basically replace it or replace parts of it.
Mm-hmm. So the feedback loops that are there, I think I got it. You mentioned this thing. Well, the truth in science is mainly true because it's peer-reviewed. So this means there is some scientific community that peer-reviews it and says, okay, it fits to what we know so far, or there are no arguments that we have to change what we know so far, and so on. So there's no truth outside of this feedback. So all truths and all stable stuff is produced inside the systems. So, but this is some philosophical constructivist perspective, and this is a system theory perspective. So this is mainly, well, the schools I was educated into, but they interested me the most. But the thing is, if you look at narratives, then it's also the discourse, the history that you grow up with. So it's not just then it's not just true because it's not falsified. It's also true because you can say, okay, they did this experiment in the past and they tried this, and somehow it's the evolution of the knowledge that leads us to this place. So it's not relativism, and then it's not arbitrary, and then this gives you some more stable ground. So this is maybe part of this feedback loop and the history of the feedback loop. So the constructivist also referred to this Ouroboros. This is the snake who always eats the tail of a snake, like over there at the game. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for your question. Thank you for your talk. I would ask for one more applause so we can finish on time. And thank you very much.